Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip. Thank you for tuning in once again. And thank you for once again just storming us in these iTunes charts. It's blowing my mind that we went straight into number one. We've not really gone out of the top five much. I think we dropped in the top 10 at one point. But yeah, it's amazing. So thank you for subscribing and sharing. And this one is one that I'm hugely excited about you all to hear. I'm going to talk about the sponsors in a minute, but first, I just right at the start, I wanted to say this is one that's basically, I know that a lot of my fan base will be specifically tuning in for maybe the hip hop ones or the music based ones and things like that, and they may not know of Simon Singh. I mean, he's very known in his areas, but may not know of Simon from my fan base. But this is the one to listen to. This is the one to get to know him. But I'll quickly go over the sponsors. We are brought to you today by Speech Development Records, which is my record label. Check us out. We've got Sage Francis, we've got B Dolan, we've got myself, we've got War and Peace, we've got Giacomo Brown, we've got Polar Bear, we've got a lot of good stuff all over at scroobiuspip.co.uk. There's a merch section, there's all sorts of other stuff, so come fuck with us. We're also brought to you by Redshift Rebels. That is a clothing company that decided that the money that companies spend on marketing is kind of gross, so they decided to not spend their money on marketing. They decided instead to spend it on music and putting on live events and putting out EPs and stuff like that and mixtapes from artists. You may then go, well, they've got an advert here. They've not paid for this. They've got a load of free advertising spots here. I think this might be the last one that we agreed on. But yeah, they got a load of free spots because in the early days of my career, they put out a little EP for me, a little mixtape. They put me on at numerous of their Rebels nights, and they now DJ regularly at my We Are Lizards Club night. So yeah, just sharing the love there. So that's cool. If you go to Redshift Rebels website, you will be able to get a 25% discount by entering the discount code free cheese. So go and do that. And finally, we've got onit.com, which is a fascinating one because I tried to talk in this podcast to Simon Singh about some of their products and he didn't actually have knowledge on it, which was interesting. I'd like him to look into it if he gets a chance, because it's fascinating. They onit.com, O-N-N-I-T, sell a lot of fitness stuff, but they're a general human optimization website. They sell stuff for exercise. They still sell supplements in that way, but they also sell nootropics, which is something that I've enjoyed, which is kind of for mental stimulation and things like that. It's a new science, so there's a lot of question marks over it. Thankfully, on it.com, they have full breakdowns of tests that have been done, and blind tests and double blind tests and neutral stuff. So, you know, you can make your own mind up. Hopefully, someone like Simon will cast an eye over them as well to get their opinion on it. So yeah, that's the sponsors. Oh, and if you go to onit.com/scroobiuspip, you'll get 10% off for being a listener of this podcast. So that's onit.com/scroobiuspip. That's the spelling section over of today's podcast. So yes, Simon Singh, it's very exciting to have him on. He's the first MBE we've had on, which is exciting. But he's a scientist, a mathematician, an author. He's a fascinating guy. I first saw him at one of Robin Ince's events. And yeah, I want to gush and tell you about all the things that we talk about, but it's best for you to just listen. Basically, he brought some very exciting things into the studio. He does some kind of experiments and he does some explanations of things that are absolutely fascinating. So I'm not going to talk any longer. I'm just going to stop now and say enjoy podcast number 6 with Simon Singh. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
Shall
we begin?
Yeah.
Right. Well, yes, this is the Distraction Pieces podcast, and I'm joined by Simon Singh, MBE, our first ever MBE in the studio. So
I'd forgotten I had an MBE.
A pleasure to have you here, sir. It's great to have you along. How's your are you good today? How's your journey been? You all right?
Yeah, all fine. Just all hectic as usual. Lots of things happening that I'm way behind on, but yeah, nice to be here.
It's always the way. It's going to be good to have a chat. For anyone who doesn't know, you're an author specialising in writing, and indeed talking about is where I first saw you, maths and science, or kind of in an accessible manner. I met you and saw you at one of Robin Ince and Brian Cox's shows, and again it was just great to sit and watch and hear about these things that maybe I don't know, I would have been scared to learn about potentially, but hear them in an accessible and comfortable manner.
Well, Robin's been an absolute star in terms of bringing people like me onto a stage, because you know, I write about science and I talk about science, but even when I talk about science, it tends to be in a lecture theatre rather than a real theatre. And so a few years ago, Robin asked me and Ben Goldacre and a couple of others to talk about science in a pub. And we had a couple of comedians there as well, talking about philosophy and other things. And that then grew into these giant, you know, Hammersmith Apollo, events. Manchester O2 events with Brian there as well. Brian Cox, who, you know, just brings in this huge audience of people that are hungry for knowledge and interesting stuff. So, it's a real thrill for me to be able to talk about science in front of a very general audience.
And it's great that it all feeds each other, essentially. That I'd say if any of you aren't familiar with Ben Goldacre, he was another one that just blew me away with everything he was teaching and saying on stage. So I recommend people check more out. So how was that for you to go from writing or from teaching potentially in a lecture theatre over to being kind of performing, I guess?
Thank you for the compliment. It was kind of performing, yeah. I did try it out before. There's a chap called Richard Wiseman. People may or not know Richard, but he's written books. He's a psychologist. He's a professor of psychology. He's made some extraordinary YouTube videos. I think he's had something like 160 million views.
Wow.
It's astonishing the reach he has. And I'd seen him give a talk, and he's also a magician, I should say.
Yeah.
So a lot of his psychology comes from insights he derives from being a magician.
Wow.
And so I saw him give a really great lecture, and I said, this is something that should go to a bigger audience. So he and I decided to put on a show where I would do the first half, he would do the second half, and we'd do it in a theatre. And the theatre that kind of was up for giving it a go was the Soho Theatre, which you know, encourages new ideas and new writers. And it was great. We just sold out. You know, sold out a whole week of shows. And then we went to Dublin, we went to New York, an off-Broadway theatre. We went to Edinburgh for The Fringe. We came back to London, did another show. And that was really about having a spectacle. I mean, again, Richard's got a great eye for what's going to capture people's imagination. So we had what are called Tesla coils. Tesla coils generate bolts of lightning.
Yeah.
And we had million volt bolts of lightning flying across the stage in quite a small theatre. And each evening, the audience would vote for one of us to go inside a metal cage. Now, the metal cage is called a Faraday cage, and it conducts the electricity and the current around you. Absolutely essential. You're not touching any part of the cage. And the audience would vote for who would go in the cage. And I remember my future wife came along with her mother, my future mother-in-law, and she very rapidly voted for me to go inside the cage. And I've never forgotten that.
It's a good test.
So people in the audience were just maybe 10 feet from the cage. Mm. And what happens is lightning, I think the way my chemistry is not so great. My background's more in physics, but my chemistry memory tells me that the lightning bolts react with the nitrogen in the air and the oxygen in the air to create nitric acid.
Right.
And the nitric acid filled the room with this really acrid odor, kind of a burning odor to the back of your throat. And if you were in the cage, it was absolutely horrible.
Yeah, of course.
That was a fun experiment that we did in a theater.
It's beautiful because there was obviously a time when that exact kind of thing was what was selling out theaters, and you know, it's what was drawing an audience
whether it be as a magician or as a as scientist, is, you know, displaying this new technology. So it's great to kind of to return to that.
Yeah, I mean, the science was magical. You know, people were creating X-rays. They were creating communication through the ether. They were generating these electrical currents of magnetic phenomena for the first time. So the centre of all of this is the Royal Institution, a magnificent building in Mayfair on Albemarle Street. Mm-hmm. You can still go there today. And if you go inside and you look at some of the paintings, you have people like Dickens, members of the royal family, all sat in these scientific lectures, watching the great scientists of the day, liquefying air.
Yeah.
You know, an extraordinary thing to see.
Yeah, yeah.
And Albemarle Street, where this institution is based, was the first one-way street in London, because the carriages would clog it up with visitors coming to see these lectures. So first one-way street, all because people were desperate to see science. Yeah.
That's beautiful, and it's great to see that returning with the talks that Brian gives at these at the Hammersmith Apollo and all these, and Robin and yourself and all of that. So that's amazing.
Yeah, it's a real joy to do a big event with Robin and Brian and to see young kids who are just nerds and geeks and proud of it, with their parents or older brothers and sisters or people that have hated science in the past but are now curious again.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's just a thrill to be part of that just whole
being,
endeavour.
And it being a night out, not a lesson. It's a night out. And that's what excited me about them, was the mixture of comedy music and science and maths and everything else, but in palatable enough chunks for it to not feel overwhelming. There's no point, or there might have been a one or two points where I felt kind of ignorant and I just thought, oh, I'm not getting this at all. Because if there's something that's slightly too much, you're on to the next thing, and it's just this amazing, engaging thing.
We did that with one of the things that Richard did in one of our shows was he had a contortionist.
Right.
And so, you know, we would see the contortionist perform and get inside this small Perspex box and, you know, be carried off stage in this small Perspex box, I think.
Amazing.
But the scientific angle of it was that no one had put a contortionist inside an MRI scanner before. Nobody had actually seen what their bones and their ligaments are doing.
Richard had
placed her inside an MRI. And so you had the scientific element, which was the medical imaging and the discussion of anatomy, coupled with the performance of the contortionist.
That's amazing, break it down in that way. And in a way, it feels like it's the kind of the ruining the magic trick type element of it. It's not, but it makes it all the more fascinating, because that's in reality what everyone really wants to know. How does the body work in that way? How can it bend and move around and maintain that?
There's a Richard Dawkins book called Unweaving the Rainbow, mm-hmm. which is a line taken from a Keats poem.
Yeah,
and I think what Keats was saying was that, again, when Keats was writing his romantic poetry, this is when these great scientific breakthroughs were happening and the Royal Institution was flourishing. So what he was writing about was that there were these darn scientists who were analysing the rainbow, stripping it apart, and therefore destroying its beauty. And I think what Richard Dawkins writes about in his book, Unweaving the Rainbow, and many other scientists have said as well, is that, you know, any scientist can sit on a hillside and stare at a rainbow in awe. And you know, I've got a 4-year-old. So what's great is you do it all over again because you're trying to show them the wonder of a rainbow.
Yeah, yeah,
so you never ever forget that. But at the same time, you add to its beauty by having an understanding of how it works.
Yeah.
And that goes for everything from the anatomy of a flower to the stars and the planets above us. Understanding what's going on only makes it more miraculous.
Completely. I think it was at one of the events where someone simply stated and pointed out that a rainbow only has one side. And that blew my mind. That just to me, and it made me appreciate a rainbow all the more, because that it's something that had never crossed my mind. It's such a simple thing, but that only exists on one side, essentially.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think. So what you have to do is you have to have the sun behind. You have to have the sun behind you.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I've done this with my four-year-old. It's been a bit rainy, and we see the sun, and we say, okay, I bet you now, if we turn around, we're going to see a rainbow.
That's amazing.
And you turn around, bang, it's there. And the ability to be able to predict the location of a rainbow is again, it's just great fun.
Even more magical to know exactly where it is. Well, we only arranged this podcast last night, and and you sent me an email, a list of things you could potentially just pull out of a hat and chat about, and it's made me already think that we're going to have to do at least two of these at some point, because there was such an amazing list. So is there any way you'd like to start, or do you want me to
direct or lead? Away.
I'll go straight off. What made you come to mind, as I mentioned in text, I think, was I saw the trailer for the new Turing film, and the thing, one of my highlights from these events was you explaining how the Enigma code was cracked and how the Enigma machine worked, and seeing that, and so would we like to start there?
Sure. So my first book was something called Fermat's Last Theorem.
Yeah.
And this is the most notorious problem in the history of maths, and it's a 350-year-old problem, and it's got a very romantic story. It's all about human obsession and childhood ambition and so on. And it covers the whole history of maths, because this problem has touched upon so many areas of mathematics. And one of the bits of that book was about Alan Turing.
Yeah.
Because Alan Turing, you know, people would talk about it a bit more in a second maybe, but people associate him with code breaking, but he was also a pioneer of computing. You know, everything in this studio is based on the ideas of Alan Turing.
Yeah.
He worked on the way that the colours of animals' coats behave. You know, why does a cheetah have spots, and why do the spots on a cheetah's tail turn into stripes? He worked on those ideas. He worked on the fundamentals of mathematics. He was an extraordinary man, and I crammed it into a tiny few pages in this book about Fermat's Last Theorem, and I've talked about his breaking of the Enigma code. But the frustration of having to cram it into just a few pages then triggered me to write a whole book about code breaking.
Yeah.
And it's called The Code Book.
The Code Book, right.
And it goes from ancient Egypt and the ancient Greeks. So, for example, one of my favourite examples of code of a code is something called a steganographic code.
Right.
So a cryptographic code is I jumble up the message and you can't read it. It's just gobbledygook.
Sure.
Steganographic code is one where I make the message invisible. So an invisible ink is a classic example. Yeah. You don't even know the message is there.
Okay.
And my favourite example of steganography was a Greek king who wanted to get a message across the border. So he got the messenger, shaved the messenger's head, tattooed the message on the messenger's scalp, waited for the hair to regrow, and then sent the messenger across the border.
Right.
So, which is lovely, because you don't even know the guy's got the message, but at the other end, you shave the head and you reveal the message. So it's full of those kind of things.
That's amazing. That's great, the idea of kind of, I mean, yeah, it may sound odd, but the secretness and the getting the message across is more important than the, I don't know, showing of your intelligence of hiding the message, do you know what I mean? So in the first form, it's like, we've got a code and you're not going to be able to break it.
Yeah.
Whereas the second form is, you don't even know we've got a code. You don't even know, what we're trying to get across here.
In the last 20 years, there's been a big debate about whether codes should be freely available.
Right.
You know, I can download some free software, encode a message, send it to you. Mm-hmm. We could have done it last night when we were emailing each other. Yeah. And nobody in the world would have been able to crack that code. All the world's secret services using all the world's computers working for a billion years would not have been able to break our code.
Oh, wow.
So this is a great thing in one way, but it also means organised criminals, terrorists and other people can use these codes. So there was a real debate about should we ban codes, or if somebody's using a bit of a cryptographic software, should they give the key to some third party that would have to release the key if a judge asked for it or whatever.
Sure.
But all of that's meaningless if you don't even know a message is being sent.
Yeah.
You know, you can if you can use steganography, then you can't stop something that you can't even see.
Yeah.
And so we were talking about the ancient Greeks and shaving heads and so on, but this whole steganographic area is very popular today with people hiding messages and things in objects that you're not even aware that the message exists. So I talked about that. We talked about you know, the Victorians, in the 19th century, it was much cheaper to send a newspaper than it was to send a letter.
Right.
Because it was just felt important that newspapers were distributed through the post. Sure. And so you would send messages by using pinpricks to pin certain holes in the letters of a newspaper and then send the newspaper. And then that would be a cheaper way of sending a letter. So the book goes through all of these different codes and who made the codes and who broke the codes and how that changed history. But the biggest chapter is all about the Enigma and the Germans and the Second World War, because what you have is a shift from shaving heads and pinholes in paper and scribbling with invisible inks to something mechanical. You move to a technological form of encryption, and that's what the Enigma is. Between the wars, between the First World War and the Second World War, the Germans realised that the power of radio was enormous. You know, you can send messages across battlefields in a second, but you have to protect those messages. And so they developed this thing called the Enigma machine. And I'm really lucky that I've got an Enigma machine.
You have. I've been looking at it at the desk on the desk there for some time now.
And it just, you know, if people haven't seen one before, it looks just like a wooden box about a foot by a foot by 6 inches deep. And you open it up and it looks just like a typewriter. It's got a keyboard. And if you type letters on the keyboard, then lights light up on the lamp board.
Yeah.
So if I type the letter A, I don't know if you can just see there, the W's lit up.
Right, yeah.
And if I type A again, a C has lit up.
Yeah.
And so I'm typing in the same letter.
And it's changing each time.
And the output's changing. So one of the basic codes that you might use as a school kid is you might replace A with B, B with J, C with D, and so on.
Yeah.
But if you keep replacing the same letter with, you know, a particular symbol or a particular other letter, that's an easy code to crack.
You can figure that out. Yeah. Whereas the Enigma machine is using a different letter
every
time.
Exactly. So, and the way this works, I can just open up the lid of the machine. And that clunking noise that people can hear at home is that every time I type a letter, a rotor here moves.
Yeah.
Because the wire from the wire from the key goes through a set of three metal rotors, and each rotor is like spaghetti inside. So the wiring inside this rotor goes into the wiring inside that rotor, goes into the wiring inside that rotor, but the rotors keep changing, and because the rotors keep changing, the wiring changes, because the wiring changes, the encryption changes.
Sure.
And if I'm sending messages to you, again, so it's, you know, late one evening, we're sending each other messages, you've got an Enigma, I've got an Enigma. If somebody wants to break our code, okay, they've got to have an Enigma machine like this, but they've also got to have it set up exactly the same way.
That's what I was going to ask. Is it so it's specific settings in there, so it's not random, but it's random to someone who doesn't have that
specific setting. So we might say, we're going to have this rotor in this orientation. We're going to move this rotor to that orientation. We're going to move this one to that orientation. What else can I do? When this rotor does a full revolution, it kicks the next one. When that one does a full revolution, it kicks the next one.
Yeah.
I can change those kickover points. Mm-hmm. There are plugs down here at the very front, which all they do, there's a simple array of plugs here.
Yeah.
All they do is if I plug A with B, that means every time I type A, it follows the path of B. And every time I type B, it follows the path of A.
Right.
So I can rearrange these plugs at the front. And there are only 20 plugs there, so I can swap 10 pairs of letters.
Yeah.
And there are 100 million... There are 100 million... Let me get this right. 100 million different ways to rearrange those plugs.
Wow.
It's a phenomenal number. I once gave a talk...
It's insane from such a small amount that all the different combinations, obviously.
Yeah, it's like saying if you've got 26 chairs and you've got 20 people, how can you rearrange 20 people into 26 chairs? It's kind of the same sort of question.
This is going to be a really odd link now, but at the weekend I was ordering a pizza from Domino's, and on their menus they've got a new thing now that says more topping combinations than people on the earth.
Yeah.
So it's that same thing. And me and my brother both looked at it and went, no, they haven't. But again, if that that's just 20, you know, if they've got 30
exactly
toppings to choose from, and you can have any Yeah.
Numbers explode very rapidly. So I gave a talk about the Enigma at the British Museum once, and I said, you know, okay, 20 plugs in 26 holes. How many different ways can you do this? And a kid put his hand up. He was about 8 years old. He put his hand up. And I said, okay, so how many ways do you think you can do this? And he was obviously a bit nervous and a bit quiet. So I said, oh, do you think it's more than 100? Do you think it's more than 1,000? Still silence. I said, do you think it's more than 10,000? And he shook his head and said, no, I think it's 26 factorial over 20 factorial times 20 times. So like, he was a little child genius.
And, amazing.
He was pretty spot on. But So if someone's going to break our code, they've got to have a machine like this set up in the exact same way.
Right.
And in the run-up to the war, everybody knew the Germans had this, but mm-hmm. everybody assumed it was unbreakable. Right. It's got so many combinations. It was a massive leap forward in cryptographic technology. And the only people who dared to try and break it were the Poles, because the Poles were sandwiched on one side by the Russians, or sandwiched between the Russians and the Germans. So they knew they were going to get invaded sooner or later.
Yeah.
And when the situation is that desperate, you try to do even the impossible. And they had the audacity to try and crack the Enigma. And they made some progress. They figured out some ways of levering the code. And just before Poland was invaded, they smuggled their breakthroughs to the British. The British had already set up a code-breaking centre at Bletchley Park, which I think people are now fairly familiar with, this estate near Milton Keynes, where all the code-breakers worked. And so those British code-breakers had a head start. And so they built on the Polish breakthroughs. And over the course of the war, they were able to read the Enigma. They invented their own code-breaking techniques. And over mm-hmm. the course of the war, they were in a position where for large chunks of the conflict, they could read the Enigma kind of as easily as the German military could read it.
Wow.
It was an incredible intellectual and technological breakthrough. And the new film that kickstarted this is The Imitation Game.
Yes,
with Benedict Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure exactly to what extent it is fiction and to what extent it's based mm-hmm. on fact, but the stories at Bletchley are absolutely heroic. You know, what was done during those years to crack the Enigma and change the course of the war. Some people say breaking the Enigma won the war, and other people say, you know, it's people on battlefields who win wars. But either way, so Harry Hinsley, the military historian, said that if it wasn't for the breaking of the Enigma, then the Battle of the Atlantic wouldn't have been won so easily.
Yeah.
And so the Battle of the Atlantic would have gone on for much longer. Many more convoys, many more men would have been lost at sea. That would have delayed the launch of D-Day.
Yeah.
D-Day would have had to be postponed by a whole year to wait for good weather the following year. During that year, Hitler's V weapons would have bombarded the south coast, which would have set back D-Day by another year. So the cracking of the Enigma shortened the war by at least 2 years. That much is certainly true.
That's absolutely amazing.
And that's it. That's the machine. This is it.
And how does it? What was the?
How was it broken?
Can you explain how it was broken? Okay, I feel like I'm asking the magician to explain the tricks. But can you explain how it was broken?
So, the weird thing is, if I type the letter P, I'll close the lid because then you can see how the letters are being encrypted. I'll type P. It comes out as a K. Comes with a T. Comes up as a G. It will never come up as a P. P will never be encrypted as P. Mm-hmm. A Q will never be encrypted as Q, and so on and so on. Now, that doesn't seem like a big problem, because every letter can be encrypted as any of the other 25 except itself. That doesn't seem like a big problem. But there was a day, there's a woman called Mavis Beatty, a code breaker at Bletchley, and she picked up a message that had been encrypted, so it was gobbledygook, mm-hmm. and it looked like a random stream of letters, except there were no W's. Okay.
Right.
300 letters long, but no W's. Now that's impossible. You can't have an output that's devoid of W's.
Yeah.
Unless all you did was type W 300 times.
Right.
If you type W 300 times, then the output will have no W's. So she'd cracked the code. The message was just W 300 times.
Right.
Which is not the most interesting message in the world.
Yeah, right? Why would it have been W 300 times?
Okay, well, the motivation for that was that if you've got an unbreakable code...
Yeah.
Okay, nobody can read your messages, but what they can do is count how many messages you sent.
Right.
And if you
if there's a high velocity of messages, then it's likely that something
big's going to happen the next day.
Right? Yeah, sure.
That's called traffic analysis.
Sure.
And so, to combat traffic analysis, you send 10 messages every day, mm-hmm. or you send a certain quota every day.
Right.
So your traffic is flat. So if somebody sent 300 W's purely to maintain their quota.
To fill the quota of messages. Wow.
But now Mavis, she knows the message. It's 300 W's. She knows the output, which is what she had to start with, the gobbledygook message. Once you know the input and you know the output, you can work out the settings of the machine.
Right.
Okay, that is it's not at all trivial to work out the settings of the machine. But once you can pin down the input and pin down the output, you can see you've got a fair chance of getting at the settings.
Wow.
And so that was the real breakthrough, that if you could guess any part of the message... So, for example, if you intercept a message at 11:59, then maybe it starts off with the time of the message, 11:59. Mm-hmm. If you intercept a message coming from just over there in the North Sea or just over there in the North Atlantic, and you know there's a German weather ship over there, then maybe you can guess there are words like fog and rain and cloud and wind. And
right. So start to break it down with these.
And these are kind of mundane, boring messages. But the same settings for the machine will be used to send more important messages.
Yeah.
So what you're looking for is the machine setting on a certain day. And once you know the machine setting for that day, even if it's based on a boring message, you can use that machine setting to get other more important messages.
Yeah.
So the Mavis Beatty message we were just talking about, once she knew the settings of the machine, she deciphered a whole slew of other messages. One of them was about a planned attack on the British Navy at Alexandria. The British fleet were warned. I'm trying to remember the name of the admiral. I think he even went onto the land to play a round of golf because he knew that German spies would see him playing golf and think, ah, right, he really got no idea what's happening.
Right,
then
yeah.
Then he snuck That's back amazing. On board the ship in the middle of the night. They were prepared for the attack, and the result was the first Allied victory.
Wow.
Or in the Mediterranean, all because Mavis had spotted this little... And then the Alan Turing, coming back to Alan Turing, his great... one of his great contributions was to build a machine called a bomb or a bomber. And what the bombs could do is they could take the input to the machine, take your guessed input and your output... And then work out the settings of the machine from that. So the bomb would kind of automate that process of figuring out the settings given some sort of input and what you have as the output. And that just changed the course of the war.
Amazing. Amazing the simplicity of that initial 300 W's and that, the thing essentially that started off the unravelling of that.
That's it. And you just had people who had different mindsets. So I don't know Mavis's background. I suspect she was a mathematician. Turing was a mathematician. People like Gordon Welshman was more of an engineer. So he would be able to, he said, well, okay, Turing, you want to build this. This is how we could build it. People like Hugh Alexander was a chess player. So not a formal scientist or a formal engineer, but just loved thinking about problems in unusual ways.
Yeah.
And that team of people somehow were able to tackle this machine from a range of different avenues and to destroy its security.
Yeah.
And all of these people, of course, after the war, were sworn to secrecy. So the whole Bletchley story...
Oh, wow, I didn't even realise that was there.
Oh, God, no, there were people... I met a guy, Michael Ventris and John Chadwick. Okay, Michael Ventris and John Chadwick deciphered a form of ancient Greek called Linear B.
Right.
And when I say ancient, I mean sort of 2,000-3,000 BC, maybe even more. This is truly archaic Greek, and for years nobody knew what this was, but they cracked the code, and. And I interviewed John Chadwick, and I talked to him about this. And I said to John, he was a very old man when I met him. He was probably late 1990s. And I said to him, you know, you're a classic scholar, you're clearly interested in Greek and so on, but why did you get into cracking this mysterious script? And he said, look, I never told anyone before, but I was at Bletchley Park.
Oh, wow.
And so there are all of these people who for decades... It's not something you were supposed to talk about. And so that was of a mind of
national security, of not putting them at risk equally, if they're known to be the ones that have cracked these codes.
Yeah, and so, that links to the tragedy of Alan Turing's story, is that Turing, you know, we said earlier, was a computer pioneer, worked on something called morphogenesis, worked on the fundamentals of mathematics, worked on code breaking, sworn to secrecy in terms of his contribution in the war. But after the war, because he was a homosexual, he lost his security clearance, he couldn't work on government projects, couldn't work on military projects, was found guilty, I guess, of gross indecency in the 50s. Was put on kind of hormone therapy, and it seems very likely that he committed suicide.
It's
all a bit unclear, but I think that's where most people seem to have come to the conclusion that he dipped an apple in cyanide and took a bite from the apple.
Right.
But when he was buried, nobody knew about his great contribution to the war. Nobody knew that perhaps more than anybody else he'd changed the course of the war.
It's insane, isn't it? Yeah. And to go through, obviously, everything I said, to have all his clearances removed, and just generally in society to be punished and chastised for his sexuality is bad enough as it is, but when you've given this, or when you've had a great contribution on this society, still holding together and still being there.
Yeah, and Turing's story is perhaps the most tragic, but there are people that their headmasters would have written to them and said, there's one case, I'm trying to remember the name of the chap, but I've forgotten. His headmaster wrote to him and said, you know, you're a disgrace to your school. He'd obviously gone to one of the great public schools in the country. And said, you're a disgrace to your school because while your friends were battling in France, you had some cushy civil servant's job.
Yeah.
And he couldn't explain that he was cracking the codes that were saving the lives of his school friends.
Yeah.
And this happened time and time again. These people just didn't get the credit. And the reason for the secrecy, on the one hand, you think the war's over. Mm-hmm. You know, why keep all this hush-hush? And the reason for the secrecy is that the Germans had thousands of these machines, and the Allies swept through Europe and collected these machines, and the British probably gathered hundreds of these machines, brought them back to London, and then somebody in Whitehall would have rung up other countries like Australia and Canada and said, look, we've captured these great German Enigma machines, the Germans say they're unbreakable, why don't you have some? So the British would give away these machines to their friends and then spy on them for the next few decades. That's why this was kept so secret.
To keep that. That's amazing.
Yeah. And I got a letter from a guy once in Canada. I guess he must have been in his 30s. And he said, you know, I read about a guy in your book called Bill Tutt. And he was my next door neighbour. And when I was a young teenager, he would help me with my maths homework. And what Bill Tutt had never told this kid was that he had made an equally great contribution at Bletchley, cracking what's known as the Lorentz cipher, which was kind of Hitler's personal cipher for the most high-grade military communications.
Right.
And Bill Tutt lived, you know, he emigrated to Canada, and people just didn't know. He'd made this incredible, incredible contribution. The cracking of the Lorentz cipher is one of the greatest intellectual feats of the 20th century.
Yeah.
I wish I understood it, to be honest.
Yeah, wow.
I understand the cracking of the Enigma. The cracking of the Lorentz kind of just goes a bit over my head. So
let's not even start on that.
Yeah, let's leave Lorentz to one side for today.
That's amazing. I'm struggling to continue on a path here because that's just all mind-blowing stuff. But other books, I wanted to talk to you about a Trick or Treatment. It's also one of the areas I found fascinating when hearing Ben Goldacre talk about medicine, about the myths and everything kind of behind it. So what was your reason for writing a Trick or Treatment, and what's it about?
So my motivation was Science is very precious to me. Science is a way of understanding how the universe works, and it's a way of, we're little animals with little brains on a small planet, and yet we can look out into the universe and we can understand the age of the universe, the evolution of the stars. We can, I can understand so much about our own bodies and the causes of illnesses and the treatments for illnesses and so on. And so when I see irrationality, it annoys me. And it particularly annoys me when I see that irrationality can harm people. Because unless you have a scientific training, it's easy to have the wool pulled over your eyes.
Yeah.
And I'm not a biologist. So when it comes to things like evolution and genetics and so on, I can be as baffled as anybody else.
Sure.
I was in, there were a couple of things that happened. One was I came across an advert for homeopathy to treat malaria, or not to treat malaria, to protect you against malaria.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing about homeopathy is that there's nothing in it. The philosophy of homeopathy, it's 200 years old, there's a guy called Samuel Hahnemann, and his philosophy was that if you suffer from hay fever makes your eyes water and your eyes itch. What else makes your eyes itch and makes your eyes water? Well, onions do. So maybe a little of what causes a symptom can somehow stop the symptom.
Right.
It's quite an ancient philosophy in medicine. It goes back to the ancient Greeks. But what harms you can heal you is kind of the philosophy.
They are that in a small amount you can build up build up an immunity or build up some kind of protection against it.
It sounds a bit like a vaccination, doesn't it? That's a kind of philosophy. Like cures like was the buzz phrase. So you would take your onion juice and you would dilute it because you don't obviously put onion juice in your eyes. So you dilute it and you dilute it and you dilute it and you dilute it. And the way you dilute it, you take one drop of onion juice into 100 drops of water, mix it up. One drop of that into 100 drops of water, mix it up. One drop of that into 100 drops of water. If you do that 12 times, the little beaker of water at the end has got no onion juice left.
Yeah.
But homeopaths will continue diluting. They'll continue diluting something that doesn't have any onion juice left in it.
Yeah.
And then the final remedy at the end, they'll take a sugar pill, drip a bit of the final remedy onto the sugar pill, and that sugar pill is now your homeopathic pill to treat you for hay fever.
Yeah.
And it makes no scientific sense. Chemists would laugh at it, physicists would laugh at it, doctors would laugh at it. But you can buy it anywhere. And there's a whole industry. And I say industry because it's a multi-million dollar industry.
Yes, of course.
And so people were selling this to protect students, people on their gap years, people traveling overseas against malaria.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't believe it. You know, malaria is a serious condition and you can't treat it with a sugar pill.
Yeah.
And I couldn't quite believe this was true. I couldn't believe that somebody was selling it. I couldn't believe people would go for it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and it's huge, obviously. So, yeah. Like homeopathy is. Yeah.
Yeah, because
as you said, a multi-million.
So I asked a young student working with a charity called Sense About Science. I'm now a trustee of Sense About Science, but at the time I wasn't. And so I went to Sense About Science. I said, do you have someone I can work with on this? A young person, a recent graduate, and there was a woman called Alice Tuff. She and I cooked up a story. And the story was that she was going to go to West Africa for 10 weeks on an open truck tour.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to use homeopathy instead of conventional treatment. And she approached 10 homeopaths, and every single homeopath said, here, take these sugar pills. Except they didn't call them sugar pills. They said, here, take these homeopathic pills instead of conventional malarial protection.
Yeah.
Every single homeopath we approached was willing to send this poor woman off to West Africa, where there are strains of malaria that will kill within 3 days, were willing to let her leave unprotected. And so that made me annoyed. I worked at the BBC for about 6 or 7 years, and they made a documentary about which gave the very, very strong impression that you could use acupuncture instead of general anaesthetic. I actually did a kind of disgusted of Tunbridge Wells and submitted a complaint to the BBC, which was eventually upheld. But you know, they showed a woman in Shanghai having major heart surgery, and the line was, in this 21st century surgical team, this 21st century surgical team is using a 2,000-year-old technique to control pain. Instead of a general anaesthetic, they're using acupuncture. Now they weren't using. They were actually using three of the most powerful sedatives known to mankind. That was not mentioned anyway. So those two things, the fact that there were people out there offering homeopathy for malaria, the fact that the BBC were misleading the general public in this kind of way, mm-hmm. the fact that there are dodgy adverts, that there's rose-tinted articles in the colour supplements. There's so much misinformation out there that that I wanted to kind of set the record straight.
Yeah.
So I teamed up with a guy called Professor Edzard Ernst, who mm-hmm. Is the world's first professor of complementary medicine.
Right.
So as I said earlier, I'm not a biologist, I'm not a medic. So he is a professor of complementary medicine, he's a trained doctor. And so we wrote this book together to tell people what does work, what doesn't work, what's dangerous. And that's what we do. We go through all the alternative therapies. And by this stage, you'll have guessed that homeopathy doesn't work. But some herbal remedies do.
I was going to say, were there any pleasant surprises along the way that you were maybe sceptical of or, that you found to have some effect?
The borderline ones are acupuncture. Acupuncture is a borderline one because there's some tiny amount of evidence that it may help with pain and nausea, but it's really, really borderline. And you have to remember there are side effects like bruising, bleeding, pain, temporary pain. There are other more serious risks as well, but they're rare. But given the borderline evidence, I wouldn't advise anybody to see an acupuncturist. Particularly, we're talking about pain and nausea. We're, a stone's throw from Chinatown. And any Chinese traditional healer who uses acupuncture will always claim to treat everything from diabetes to asthma to eczema. So suddenly, once you enter the world of acupuncture, you're not very far from a whole wild west of dodgy
all
claims.
These different things they can offer.
So homeopathy is complete quackery. Acupuncture, I think, is borderline quackery at best. Herbal medicines, the vast amount of modern medicine is based on herbs. And so do herbs work? Well, some do. Some do. So, for example, there is some evidence that St. John's wort can help with mild and moderate depression. It's only some evidence, but the evidence is there.
And do you feel that they work as a replacement or a supplement to, like, potentially any of these things?
Well, the one thing I would say about St. John's wort is that because it's a herb, it's got a whole mix of chemicals in there, and so it has side effects as well. And one of the side effects is that I think it accelerates the function of the liver. So if you're taking other medicines, your liver will break down those medicines and make them ineffective, including the contraceptive pill and some immunosuppressants, I think. So, you need to be really wary. It's not just because it's natural doesn't mean it's safe.
That's fascinating, though, because you'd think of in the best situation, they would be to work with other drugs or with other medication. But it's fascinating in that situation. That's kind of the opposite. If you're using it, you should maybe only be using it because it might be cancelling out other things or, removing the effect of proven scientific.
And I think Edson has done some surveys on the extent to which patients tell their doctors about what they're using. And most people don't bother telling their doctors that and they really have to be, because if you take a particular drug, it's probably a very pure synthesis of a very specific drug. Whereas if you take St. John's wort, it's a whole mixture of a whole cocktail of chemicals. So it's a much riskier process. And some herbalists, many herbalists, will mix up the herbs. They'll give you a special cocktail of a cocktail of chemicals. So there are different words. There's alternative. Now, I use the word alternative not because these therapies are used as an alternative to conventional treatment, but just because philosophically they're very alternative. They don't fit within our conventional understandings of science. They're completely, you know, alternative music. You know, you don't just listen to alternative music and nothing else. It's it's alternative because it has a different angle on music. It comes from a different place. And that's why I call these therapies alternative. Some people use them in a complementary way. So they use them, you know, alongside conventional treatments, which is not so bad. Except if they're ineffective, they're ineffective and they're wasting their money, and there may be other side effects. People talk about integrative medicine as well. People talk about holistic medicine. You know, but these are all, I just find these all very mealy-mouthed terms because, you know, if I go and see my doctor, I think he's quite holistic. You know, he'll talk to me about how I'm feeling. He'll talk to me about what kind of exercise regime I'm on. He'll talk to me about whether I should be eating a bit better. I shouldn't be drinking these fizzy drinks I've got here on the table. He'll talk to me about what my previous health. He'll talk about a whole range of different things. And then when it comes to treatment, he may consider pills, he may consider talking therapies, he may consider surgery. You know, modern medicine is really quite holistic.
Yeah.
You know, it was interesting with the malaria experiment that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
This poor woman went to the homeopaths. They just said, here, take these homeopathic pills. As a control, we sent her to a travel clinic on Regent Street, a conventional travel clinic.
Yep.
They sat her down for 20 minutes. They talked through her whole medical history. They gave her advice on what clothes to wear. They gave her advice on what insect repellents to use.
That's crazy, isn't
it? That's what I call holistic.
Yeah. That's insane, the difference there of
And I should stress, the other thing I should stress at this point, and you mentioned Ben as well, you know, people like Ben and I get accused of being big pharma shills, you know, that we're just standing up for the big pharmaceutical industry and we're attacking alternative therapies because, you know, we're somehow in the pay of conventional medicine.
Yeah.
And Ben is a conventional doctor. So, you know, it's an accusation that gets thrown at him very harshly. But I think both he and I, and particularly Ben, are as critical of conventional medicine as anybody else. Conventional medicine clearly has its problems. And one of the things that Ben started this year is something called All Trials, the All Trials campaign, which is that the pharmaceutical industry needs to be transparent and it needs to show us all the evidence it has on all the clinical trials it conducts. What it can't do, what it shouldn't do, is conduct a clinical trial. If the results are good, they publish them. If the results are dodgy, they hide them in a cupboard.
Yeah.
Which is insane
that they can do that or do that.
There are patients who take part in these trials on the understanding that they're contributing to the sum of human knowledge. They're not doing it so that the drug companies can hide it away.
Yeah.
And so what Ben's been doing, along with Centre Mat Science and a whole slew of other people, is probably one of the biggest, I wouldn't say threats to the pharmaceutical industry, but one of the biggest things to kind of keep it legal, decent and honest than anybody's done in the last 10 years. So for alternative therapists to attack him is just a complete joke. I think for Ben and me and Edzard Ernst and lots of people, it's not about being anti-alternative or pro-conventional. It's about being pro-evidence. You know, what does the evidence tell us? And then let's act on that.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, we've talked about code breaking, which blew my mind, and then going into wonderful detail here on the myths of medicine and everything else in there. Can we just talk about The Simpsons and Futurama for a bit, please?
Yes, very happy to.
Again, is it your fourth book was...
Fifth.
Your fifth was on... Yeah. And what is it? It's the maths and science within
The
Simpsons and Futurama.
So the idea is, I've worked on this book. So I started working on this book 10 years ago, and the book got derailed because of this whole alternative medicine thing that just got me frustrated. But I've been working on it for 10 years, and the idea of the book is that and people would have seen other books, you know, the theology of the Simpsons, the psychology of the Simpsons, the philosophy of the Simpsons, all great books, you know, I'm sure they're all out there and they're lovely books. But the mathematics of the Simpsons is based on the fact that the writers of the Simpsons are mathematicians. Not all of them, not every single one, but there are people who've got degrees in maths, people who've got master's degrees in maths, People have got PhDs in maths, people that have written research papers in maths. One guy was a professor at Yale. These are hardcore mathematicians. I'm a physicist, and I think I know a lot about maths.
Yeah. These guys.
These guys are in a whole league above me.
Yeah.
And they love maths, okay? Now, they're not mathematicians anymore. They're clearly comedy writers on the world's most successful TV show.
Yeah.
But they do still love their maths. And the way they express that love is by putting maths into The Simpsons when nobody's really looking. And a lot of these writers also moved across or shuttled between Futurama and The Simpsons.
Yeah.
And so there's just as much maths in Futurama. Futurama is obviously a science fiction show, so there's naturally going to be some science in there. But the mathematics is really, really only there because these writers love their numbers.
Can you give any examples of anything that you can... Obviously, we've not got a show to or a clip to put on or anything. Is there anything you can kind of
sum up
or tell?
So there's an... So in The Simpsons, there's a reference to prime numbers and Mersenne prime numbers. There's something called a perfect number. There's a narcissistic number appears in The Simpsons. There's a joke about calculus or something about Pythagoras' theorem. There's the most beautiful equation in all of maths called Euler's identity appears in two different episodes. I briefly talked about my first book, Fermat's Last Theorem.
In what way do they get it in? Sorry.
Okay, sorry. So how does it get in? So if it's something like pi.
Yeah.
We all know about pi.
Yeah.
So pi can appear as pi.
Me all proud agree. Yep, yeah. I know. I know what you're talking about now. Pi. Yep, I know. I'm familiar with pi. Go.
So, so it appears in the script, sorry, just taking a drink there.
That's fine.
So pi appears in about six different episodes.
Right.
So, for example, there's one episode where Apu wants to give evidence. Is giving evidence in a trial. Marge in Chains is the episode, and Marge is accused of theft from the Quickie Mart, and Apu is the main witness against her, and Lionel Hutz wants to kind of undermine Apu's credibility.
Yeah.
So he says to Apu, you know, you've got a terrible memory, we can't trust your evidence. And Apu says, no, I've got a great memory. In fact, my memory is so good, I can recite pi to 40,000 decimal places, and the 40,000th digit is a one. Now, he could have said, I can recite the telephone directory, the Springfield telephone directory. But he talks about pi because these writers love pi.
Yeah.
And they love it so much that the world record for memorising pi was 40,000 digits when that episode was broadcast. Now, you couldn't look up the 40,000th digit at that time because we didn't really have Google or the internet the way we do today. So they had to write to a world pi expert, a guy called David Bailey at NASA. Wow. And David Bailey sent them all 40,000 digits of pi. And I spoke to the writers. I said, OK, I like the fact you got pi in here. That's really good. I always like to see maths in The Simpsons. But why in this episode, at this moment, did you put pi in? And they said that Apu, if you look at Apu's backstory, Apu is a mathematician. Right. He studied maths and science at Caltech. He went to Caltech for his undergraduate degree. And when I say Caltech, I don't mean the California Institute of Technology. I mean the Calcutta Institute of Technology. And all of this is documented. There's an episode called Much A Poo About Nothing. And it's all there. So when it's pi, it's in the script. The other things I was talking about, which are more obscure, tend to be the title of a book. So this equation, Euler's identity, which, as I say, mathematicians think is the most beautiful equation in all of mathematics, and you don't really cover it until you get to university.
Right.
It's the title of a book next to Lisa when she's coaching the Isotots Little League baseball team in Money Bart, the episode called Money Bart. There's an episode called Treehouse of Horror 6 where Homer gets dragged into a higher dimension. It's the weird computerized graphics in one.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's an equation, Fermat's Last Theorem, my first book, there's an equation there that flies through the back of the landscape. So the really hardcore maths is put in such a way that you don't notice it unless you really know what to look for. Because Matt Groening said, look, you clearly love maths, so clearly put as much in as you want, but don't scare the viewers. Yeah. Don't scare people. So there's something called P versus NP, which crops up in also that Treehouse of Horror episode. And P versus NP is about the fact that there are some questions in maths that are hard and some that are easy.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, are the hard ones really hard or have we just not figured out how to do it?
Right.
So are these in a different category, the hard ones? Or if we could figure out how to do them, would they also be easy?
Yeah.
And nobody knows. So people say it's P, which kind of means easy, versus NP, which means hard. You know, are they easy and the hard ones? Are they different? Now, in The Simpsons, the equation is written P equals NP. So in The Simpsons, they're claiming that the hard ones will become easy.
Right,
the hard
yeah.
ones are equal to the easy ones, really. But in Futurama, they say exactly the opposite. In Futurama, there's a suggestion that P does not equal NP.
Right.
So you have a debate about an unresolved mathematical problem across two animated sitcoms, and this just doesn't happen in any other, you know, sitcoms.
Yeah.
There's $1 million if you can solve this problem, and it's being debated in Futurama and in The Simpsons.
That's amazing.
It's just weird, and it just it goes on and on and on.
That's great. what was that? I want to ask. What was the motivation for writing a book about that? But was it purely just the fascination of it? The fact that it's crazy, that all of this is in there and hunting it out. In a way, the codes that we don't know are there, as you discussed right at the start. That kind of, they're hidden in there, but the general public won't notice them until you or someone similarly points them out and goes,
I think you know what that means. They call them freeze frame gags, which means you don't see them until you freeze the frame. But they are kind of like steganographic references. They're only there. You just don't see them otherwise. And for me, I'm just always looking for ways of getting other people as interested and excited about maths and science as I am. The thing about Fermat's Last Theorem is that it is just an incredible story. So I wrote that story because you just couldn't make it up. Codes, the code book, you know, it's about secrecy and military conflict and, you know, privacy in the 21st century. These are issues that we should all be interested in and we're naturally interested in. So it's a great way of then... You know, I'm always trying to get the maths in because that's what I love.
It's finding the ways of making it intriguing and accessible in that way. Codes instantly. As you said, it's maths equations essentially a lot of the time. But a code is exciting because it's spies and it's wars and it's crime, you know, all this kind of secrecy.
And then with The Simpsons, you know, I love The Simpsons, I love Matt, I love Futurama. And there's another group of people out there who won't pick up Fermat's Last Theorem because it kind of sounds scary.
Yeah.
But they will pick up The Simpsons and Their Mathematical Secrets because the thought of having Homer hold your hand as you go through this mathematical landscape is more comforting.
Yeah.
But the maths in The Simpsons is just as tricky as the maths in Fermat's Last Theorem. In Fermat's Last Theorem, I talk about infinity. And infinity plus one is still infinity, and two times infinity is still infinity. In The Simpsons book, I explain that there are actually different scales of infinity, that there are some infinities that are bigger than other infinities. So, the maths in The Simpsons and Futurama is not trivial.
Yeah.
It's hardcore because these writers are really, really, really strong on their maths.
It's great though to as you said that the fact it's got Simpsons and Futurama in the title and theme is going to make a lot of people more comfortable picking it up and it working as or as a non-homeopathic gateway drug, I guess, into the other stuff, which is, as you said, equally as in depth, but you might not have taken that leap because it's scarier.
And then that comes back to what we were talking about at the beginning. You know, there are some people who won't pick up a book of 300 pages, but they will come to a night out at the Bloomsbury Theatre and watch a show where they're going to get a bit of cosmology and a bit of chemistry and a bit of maths and so on. So it's just giving, and there's some amazing things on the internet now.
Yeah.
There's something called Numberphile, which are just short 5-10 minute videos. And every time they come out, they get 1 million hits.
Yeah.
Because there's a whole group of people there that want their maths in those kind of 5-10 minute bite-sized chunks. And that's great too. There's great, I go to the Baker's at my local train station, and the guy looks at me and says, "Hey, you're the Numberphile guy." Because, he's not read any of my books, but he's seen me on the Numberphile videos. So
that's fantastic.
And this month, this year is the 100th, is the centenary of the birth of a guy called Martin Gardner. Most people won't have heard of Martin Gardner, but he was a popular science writer. He was a what we call a skeptic or a rationalist. He wrote the best maths puzzles book in the world.
Right.
And again, puzzles is another way of getting into maths. And
yeah,
Martin
completely.
Was the doyen of those puzzles. It said that his puzzles turned thousands of children into mathematicians, but they also turned thousands of mathematicians back into children because his puzzles are so playful. They're just really intriguing.
That's beautiful. Well, I mean, we've gone over the hour mark. There's still tons of things I want to talk about, but I'll probably stream things down. Let's. Are you wanting to do a demonstration with the
with
your laptop?
This.
Let's try this out. Go ahead.
So this was when I was looking at codes.
Yeah.
And I'll just play this. This is Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven, backwards. Okay. I'll just have a listen to it, and people listening at home can listen to it as well. Just see what you make of it. See if you can hear any words in it. Let me put the sound up again. So did you hear anything in there at all?
Well, the one that's kind of discussed is Satan, particularly, you know, the word Satan jumping out
a couple of times. Okay, great. So you heard Satan a couple of times, and I guess other people may have heard it a couple of times as well. Now, the question is, having heard the word Satan, or maybe not heard it, did you hear, "Here's to my sweet Satan, the one whose little path would make me sad, whose power is Satan, oh, he'll give you 666. There was a little tool shed where he made us suffer, sad Satan." Did you hear any of those?
I didn't catch that.
No, okay.
I maybe didn't catch that.
So let me play it to you again. And this time, I reckon if you watch the screen, this may well not work for people at home because they can't see the words.
Yep.
But I reckon
I'm going to move away from my microphone for a second to take this in properly.
Okay.
But go ahead.
So we'll play it again, and this time we'll see if you can hear these words.
Completely saw and heard all of that. Yeah,
it's shocking, isn't it?
It really is. How? Yeah.
And the reaction I get. I mean, okay. So I say people listening will just say they didn't really
just
hear
heard
any,
the same thing.
They just heard the same thing twice because they couldn't see. And I didn't just show you the words. I lit the words up one
in order.
At a time.
That's what I was. Yeah.
And so for you, I kind of think it was probably quite a shocking, weird experience.
Yeah, completely. Because I said the first time it was just sounds, and then occasionally that potential. But again, maybe that potential Satan, because I'm aware that people say when you play it backwards, you hear Satan. So that suggestion's already there.
Exactly. That's what it's all about. It's all about the power of suggestion, that our brains are always looking for meaning. They're always trying to make sense of the world. They've evolved over a million years to try and understand the world around us and to find patterns. And if I suggest a pattern to you, and I say you will hear these patterns, and I show you the words and I light them up one at a time, your brain goes out of its way to hear those words and to try and conjure those words from the garbled noise you're hearing.
Yeah.
And your brain tricks you into hearing something that really is not there.
Yeah.
And our brains can trick us into seeing things that aren't there. Our brains can trick us into believing things that aren't true. And I like to do these demos. I'm sure I've done it at one of Robin's events a couple of times, I'm sure. And the point of doing it is to make people realise that they can't necessarily trust their own senses.
Yeah.
Seeing is not believing. Hearing is not believing. And that's why science and mathematics and technology are so important, because that allows us to take a step back and to try and be as objective as possible and try and get to the real truth of what's going on.
It's wonderful, because it's really a beautiful thing to, and a thing that is hard to take as a human when you're brought up to be that humans are humans, the mighty great, you know, lords of the planet. But the fact that, yeah, it's not all, you know, what we hear and what we see and what we hear, it's not as simple as that. Yeah, it's far more in depth than that, and we are as easily led as any creature on the on the planet, essentially.
And again, going back to homeopathy, and you know, okay, I say homeopathy is bunk and it's tosh and it's quackery and it doesn't work, but it will engender a placebo effect.
Yeah,
because if you have a belief that this homeopathic pill is going to heal you, and you have, let's say, hay fever, then your hay fever symptoms will probably seem less to you because of the power of the mind allowing you to cope with those symptoms better.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, some people might say, well, then why, you know, why be so negative about homeopathy? But for me, you know, conventional drugs, conventional treatments also have a placebo effect.
Right.
So why just shortchange people with a placebo when you can give them a real treatment plus a placebo?
Yeah.
And also, we started off talking about malaria, and mosquitoes don't know about the placebo effect.
Yeah, yeah.
So no placebo really effect is going to stop that. Yeah. So, but yeah, there is a link there that, that your mind can trick you in, into things. And the placebo is a good trick because it's a good thing regardless of where it's coming from. But it's important to be aware of that sometimes and to take a step back.
Have you looked into or discussed nootropics at all? It's a thing. It's something that I've been a fan of, and there's a lot of trials going on at the moment. There's a particular, I'm going to say the name, and it's going to sound ludicrous to you now, but it's called Alpha Brain. And nootropics in general, I've not got a good enough understanding to discuss it. But I took it when I was learning A Song of Mine backwards, and it's generally there to increase kind of sharpness and kind of just, I don't know, it feels like it's the way I describe it was, it feels like someone's going around and turning all the lights on in my brain for me. So not necessarily increasing my overall potential level, but kind of starting, you know, just getting me there that bit quicker and seeming that bit sharper.
I mean, the mind is an incredible thing, and we should try and maximise its ability and so on.
Yeah.
And I think from my point of view, the thing is always to just try and be aware of whether something is legit, whether the claims it's making really do stand up.
And the open, as you said, the open trials on everything like that, I think, has got to be absolutely key, right? Because it was mind-blowing the first time I heard either you or Ben discussing that the fact that trials go on, and if they don't go the way someone wants, they get put away. It kind of means that the trials are only there to support but not to protect. They're only there to go, look, we've done a trial and it proves we're good. Whereas
you know, what good science is about is actually trying to prove yourself wrong.
That's what
I mentioned Martin Gardner earlier, who wrote a book about religion, and oh gosh, I've forgotten what it was called—the Philosophical Meanderings of a Scrivener or something—and it got trashed. It got the worst possible review in the New York Times, and the reviewer of Martin Gardner's book turned out to be Martin Gardner, and he trashed his own book because he said, "I'm going to try and be my own worst critic because I need to understand where the weaknesses are in my own arguments and so on." And that's what scientists do. You know, they conduct an experiment; they do their best to tear it apart. And if they don't tear it apart, they stand up at a conference and all their peers will tear it apart in a way that everybody understands to be productive. Because there was a guy called Oliver Wendell Holmes, and he said, look, truth is like a football, which means you can kick it around as much as you want. But at the end of the day, if it's the truth, it will remain round and beautiful because you can't destroy it.
Yeah.
Whereas if it turns out to be it's not the truth, then you'll burst that balloon pretty rapidly.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah,
that's
yeah.
what we need to do, is to really criticise things as much as possible and step back from what we want to be true or what we hope to be true or what we've invested our money in to be true.
Yeah.
It's really just what does the evidence tell us, one way or the other.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, thank you very much for coming in. Where can people keep up to date on everything you?
I'm on Twitter. I'm SL Singh, mm-hmm. SL Singh, and that's kind of That's I'm not that's doing much at the moment, to be honest.
No, that's fine. No, that's great. Well, thank you very much for coming along. I'm sure our paths will cross again at some point down the line. But yeah, it's been fantastic talking to you, and thank you.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Lots of fun. Thanks a lot.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Scrooby's Picks Distraction Pieces.
That was Distraction Pieces podcast number 6 with Simon Singh. And how good was that? I genuinely think I'm going to have him on for another chat because it was so much. He's an amazing guy. I hit him up about this and we've only met once or twice. And he sent me an email that day saying, here's a list of things I've written books about or just interesting shit that's going on in my life at the moment, and we got through about half of that list, so I hope to talk to him again at some point. But it was absolutely fascinating, so really pleased to have him on. If you'd like to ask me any questions or follow me or hit me up, I'm at Scroobius Pipio on Twitter and on Instagram and facebook.com/Scroobius Pip. Yeah, come check me out. And that's kind of it for today. We're plugging on every week with this. It's been nice because a lot of people thought that it was only going to be four podcasts. I initially only announced the first four, which if you missed them were Russell Brand, Zane Lowe, Alan Moore and DJ Yoda. But yeah, it's a weekly thing. We ain't going nowhere, particularly since we're somehow riding the charts at the moment, which is amazing considering, as I've mentioned before, it's just me with a little mixing desk and a walkie putting it together for me at the end of the day. So anyway, I'm getting all sentimental. I'm going to leave you now. I will see you all next week when we have Warren Ellis, which is a very exciting one to have. I'm going to talk longer now because I've just remembered how exciting this is. I've pre-recorded it, obviously, so we basically have a massive nerd out. One of the really popular ones so far has been the Alan Moore one, and that was great. So fans of that, I think, will be big fans of the Warren Ellis one. The only criticism anyone had of the Alan Moore one was we didn't nerd out over comics enough and we discussed a lot of other things. Trust me, if your nerd quota is down for this month, the Warren Ellis chat will pick that right up. It was an absolute honour to talk about comic books and get really nerdy with one of the greatest writers for Marvel, for DC, for Image, for everyone. So yeah, subscribe now and check us out. Until next week, this has been the Distraction Pieces podcast. Peace.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.